Coming up, the taxes we pay, are they fair and effective?
It's a matter of sharing the burdens of a free society and of a good society. That's, morally speaking, what taxes are about.
And micro-lending. It was designed to help the poor start their own businesses and become self-sufficient. But in India, something has gone wrong.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company. And the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Welcome, I'm Bob Abernethy. It's good to have you with us. As anti-government protests continue to build in Egypt and other parts of the Muslim world, more than 2,000 Arab scholars and activists issued an urgent appeal for human rights and democracy. The group's statement said any political reforms must include respect for freedom, including the freedom of religion. And they urged more dialogue between Islamists and secularists. The diverse coalition included prominent activists from more than 20 nations. Meanwhile, a report released this week by the Pew Forum on Religion and Public Life says the number of Muslims in the world will rise at a faster rate than other groups over the next 20 years. The Muslim population worldwide is expected to reach 2.2 billion in 2030, up from 1.6 billion today. In the U.S., the number of Muslims is expected to double in the next 20 years to more than 6 million. Other findings, Pakistan will replace Indonesia as home to the world's largest Muslim population, and in some European countries, including France and Belgium, the Muslim population will surpass 10%. President Obama explicitly singled out U.S. Muslims in his State of the Union address Tuesday, saying they're part of the American family. Throughout his speech, the president called for a new era of cooperation. Several times, he noted the nation's religious diversity.
We believe that in a country where every race and faith and point of view can be found, we are still bound together as one people, that we share common hopes and a common creed.
Our managing editor, Kim Lawton, has been following religious reaction to the president's address. Kim.
I actually moderated a conversation for our website with religious people giving their reactions to the address. I've heard from and talked to many others, and a lot of the reaction did split in predictable partisan lines. Those who support the president were more positive, those who don't weren't. That was predictable. But one thing that struck me was among conservatives and liberals, I heard disappointment that there wasn't more attention on the poor. The president never actually said the poor, but when he was talking about all of the budget problems and possible cuts, he did mention he didn't want to do that on the backs of the most vulnerable in the nation. But this is an area that a lot of faith-based groups are concerned about when we're talking about making big cuts and dealing with that. How is that going to affect the poor and the marginalized? And so those are going to be some big battles coming.
The least of these.
Exactly.
And what about the language?
Well, I heard some disappointment from many fronts, again, both liberals and conservatives, that the president didn't use more moral language, spiritual and moral terms. Even when he was talking about some of the problems facing the nation, he didn't say it's the right thing to do to balance the budget or to be accountable or responsible for your money. He didn't talk about that when he was talking about clean energy. He didn't say caring for the environment, which is language a lot of faith groups like to hear. Some people say, well, this is a State of the Union address. It's a legislative package, and that's not the place for that kind of language. Certainly the president used a lot of theological language in his Tucson speech, but for many faith people, they like to hear that kind of language in every speech, and they did find that missing.
And beyond language, important as that is a kind of point of view. Yes, we need a lot more attention to math and science, but no less attention to poetry and preaching and art, all the arts and all the humanities part of it.
Well, a lot of faith communities do talk about some of those intangible things. What makes America great? Is it just economy or military? Is there something else, something deeper, something that more perhaps reflects the soul of the nation? And I do think that for a lot of faith-based groups, they think that those kinds of things should be included in a State of the Union.
Yeah, more than just what can be measured. Kim Lawton, many thanks. Again, you can watch Kim's discussion of the speech with a panel of religious analysts on our website. During the State of the Union message, the President also called on Congress to simplify the nation's tax system. As he put it, get rid of the loopholes, level the playing field. In theory, at least, everyone wants a tax code that's fair and that raises needed funds effectively. But designing tax reform also invites a collision between the different values in society. What's fair to some is unfair to others, and some of the tax reforms that are being proposed hit very close to home. Tim O'Brien has our special report.
There are some things the government must do, and the first reason for taxes is to pay for them. Beyond that, there's wide debate over how taxes can be efficient and fair and what kind of society they should promote.
People on the left think that the tax code is not nearly redistributive enough, think that the rich are really getting away with murder. People on the right think that it's not the job of government to be redistributing income, and the tax code we have is too progressive.
Greg Mankiw was the chairman of the Council of Economic Advisers in the second Bush administration.
It's a difference of values of what you think government should be. In coming to any sort of tax reform, those different values are going to collide, and there's no easy way to sort of reconcile these very different philosophical positions about what the scope of government should be.
How should income and wealth and opportunities and the good things in life be distributed?
The collision of the competing views of the role of government is the gist of a very popular course at Harvard taught by Michael Sandel, a professor and political philosopher.
The main purpose of a tax system is to raise revenue for the common good, for the public good. That's its purpose. But it has to do so in a way that is fair, that involves shared sacrifice. Because really, it's a matter of sharing the burdens of a free society and of a good society. That's, morally speaking, what taxes are about. So unless a tax system meets the test of fairness, none of its other advantages really matter.
For Peter Wehner, a former deputy assistant to President George W. Bush, the issue is freedom.
This country was founded on liberty. It wasn't founded on income equality. And there is a certain view, which I subscribe to, which says that people ought to be able to keep much or most of what they earn. And to have the government in the business of taking it and deciding how it, government, will spend it, rather you as an individual, I think is flawed, and I think it's contrary to much of the American tradition, and I happen not to think that it's consistent with ethical or moral or religious traditions as well.
But according to Michael Sandel, fairness, sharing the burdens of a free and good society, may compel a significant redistribution of wealth.
Some people do work harder than others. But what's reflected in the vast income inequalities that we've seen in recent years is not hard work primarily. School teachers work hard. Bus drivers work hard. Kindergarten teachers, daycare workers, they work hard. Do they work less hard than hedge fund managers and Wall Street bankers who reap hundreds and thousands of times what they do in the market economy? Most of the wage differences, most of the income differences, have very little to do with differences in effort. Most of them have to do with supply and demand and with the qualities that our society happens to value. And a lot of this is no doing of the people who are lucky enough to have those talents and those abilities to wind up on top. And if that's true, then it seems to me there is an obligation for those who are affluent, those who succeed under this system, to share their bounty with those who, through no fault of their own, are less well off.
In Alabama, which has its share of less well-off, families falling below the poverty level still pay income taxes and a hefty 9% tax on groceries, while many wealthy property owners pay next to nothing in property taxes. Schools suffer, and some families find it even harder because of taxes to put food on the table. The Alabama legislature is composed almost entirely of Christians, but to one critic, the state's tax policies stand Christian values on their head.
The moral principles of Judeo-Christian ethics demand that our taxes raise a level of revenue embracing the reasonable opportunity of all, and that the burden be allocated in a moderately progressive way.
Susan Hamill is seminary trained, a United Methodist, a tax attorney, and a law professor at the University of Alabama. And she's made a name for herself crusading for tax reform in Alabama based on Judeo-Christian ethics, the Bible.
The Bible, first and foremost, absolutely forbids oppression. And this is where I got started with this. In Alabama, forbids oppression. What is oppression? Oppression is taking a person who's already down, who is struggling, who is vulnerable, and making their situation worse, actively doing so.
The idea that those who write our tax laws should be in any way guided by religious beliefs has been greeted with a degree of skepticism by some leading economists like Greg Mankiw.
I don't think one can go straight from any sort of religious view to what an optimal tax system looks like. But in terms of thinking about fairness and what's the role for government, sure, I think all of our values come into play.
There's no debate tax laws should be fair. But how, in a pluralistic society such as ours, do we even define the word fair? And assuming we can define it, how far should the government go using tax dollars to promote fairness?
The aim of tax policy is to generate economic growth. A rising tide lifts all boats. I don't think that as a general proposition, using tax policy to create fairness or equality works. To take money from the rich, money that they have earned because they've worked hard, is not by itself just. And again, if you take money from the rich beyond a certain point, you're going to create disincentives for wealth creators. And that's going to have a huge effect on the poor as well.
One remedy championed by Steve Forbes in his run for the presidency in 1996 is a flat tax, 17% across the board, scrapping the current complicated and loophole-laden IRS code. The flat tax may have antecedents in the religious tradition of tithing, where each person gives the same percentage regardless of income.
Well, I think a flat tax would for sure be more efficient. And I think the strongest argument in favor of flat tax has to do with efficiency.
Many economists, like Harvard's Greg Mankiw, say the government should rely less on taxing income and more on a value-added tax on consumer goods, a form of flat tax found in much of Europe.
It's a consumption tax rather than an income tax. So it does not tax savings. So if I earn some money and I put it in the bank and don't spend it, it doesn't get taxed until I take it out and spend it later on whenever I buy. And I think there's a lot of economists have argued over the years that a consumption is a better basis for taxation than income, because consumption is actually what you're enjoying. And also, saving is a part of economic growth. So if we exempt saving until it's later consumed, that's going to tend to promote economic growth. So I think there's a strong case to be made for using consumption as the basis for taxation.
If, however, sacrifices are to be shared equally, some adjustment would have to be made for those who have little money at all and are hard-pressed to cover even the most basic necessities.
Our tax code may be the best measure of what kind of a people we are and what kind of a country we have created. The late American philosopher John Rawls defined a just society as one you would want to live in even if you did not know what your place in it would be, whether you would be rich or poor, male or female, or what your race or IQ would be.
In his course at Harvard, Professor Sandel also questions whether a country committed to equal opportunity should allow the wealthy to pass on their vast fortunes to their children and grandchildren.
If we believe that everyone should have an equal chance to work hard and aspire and succeed, then it's very difficult to justify that children of wealthy parents should have a huge advantage even before they start. The estate tax, quite apart from raising revenue, is a way a society says, we want to give everyone equal opportunity insofar as we can, and we don't want to give a huge advantage to people, to let them start way before everyone else simply because they had the good luck or the good judgment to be born to affluent parents.
If your parents, upon dying, want to give their children the money rather than going to the government, that's a perfectly reasonable thing to do. Is it fair to the children who by birth might get that money that it's taken from them and it's given to the government? I don't think that there's an ethical or moral imperative to do that.
Even if political philosophers and economists could agree on the fairest and most efficient method of taxation, that surely doesn't mean it will ever happen because of the power of special interests such as homeowners.
So why should the tax code subsidize home ownership, which is eventually at the expense of renters? On the other hand, trying to get rid of that is very hard because homeowners think they've become entitled to it. So there's no question that that's going to be a hard one to get rid of, but it's also the right thing to do. It's easy for me to talk about tax reform. I have tenure. The typical congressman has to get reelected every 2 years. And so that makes their set of constraints much more troublesome and difficult to navigate than mine.
What the tax debate makes clear is just how divided the country is over how to define the role of government and the values it should promote. For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, I'm Tim O'Brien in Washington.
We have a report now on the troubles of micro-lending in India, the combination of lending and philanthropy that came to be seen as a way out of extreme poverty in the whole underdeveloped world. Not-for-profit groups would make small loans to the very poor to help them buy a sewing machine or an animal and take a first step out of destitution. The father of micro-lending won the Nobel Peace Prize in 2006. But recently, in India, big for-profit companies moved into the micro-lending business, interest rates went up, and in many cases, the result was India's equivalent of the U.S. housing bubble. Fred DeSam-Lazaro reports.
Micro-lending began in the non-profit world as a means to help poor people start enterprises that would make them self-sufficient.
We were from the world of development, and we spent frustrating number of years trying to get small amounts of credit for poor people. And then there's a limit to how much you can do as a nonprofit. And then eventually we restructured as for-profits.
In less than a decade, micro-lending grew into a $7 billion industry. One company, SKS Microfinance, raised $350 million in an initial public stock offering. Salesmen from various new companies fanned out into rural areas like this village in the southern state of Andhra Pradesh, offering money to people, no questions asked.
They came to us continuously for 10 days and they offered loans. They said, we will give you loans and you can pay them back in easy installments. It's not a hard thing.
No sooner had one company's agents left than another's would arrive. The goal, critics of these companies say, was to increase the volume of loans so as to attract or impress the big investors, even though many borrowers earned barely $2 a day as agriculture laborers. Almost all of these women say they were coaxed into several high-interest loans, ranging from $500 to
$1,000. I have loans from three different companies, about $700 in all. I use the money from one to pay off the others, and I'll continue to do that until I can't anymore, and then I'll stop making payments.
That won't be easy, say others who've fallen behind. Pula Polapaka, a mother of two small children, says even though she and her husband had four loans, they stayed current for 3 years. But they missed three weekly installments after her husband, a house painter, took ill. The collection boys, as she calls them, began to hound them.
We left for another village where we have relatives, but the collection boys tracked us down in that village, and we were humiliated. He didn't say anything about committing suicide. He just went far away and took his life.
her husband's suicide late in 2009, and those of several dozen other borrowers gained the attention of media, politicians, and government regulators like Subramaniam Reddy.
Someday it had to burst. The bubble had to burst.
Last October, an ordinance written by Reddy was approved by the state's legislature. It mandates credit checks, monthly instead of weekly installments, and it outlawed unfair collection practices that Reddy says also jack up administrative costs and interest rates to usurious levels. He says those rates are never fully disclosed to unsuspecting, often barely literate clients.
If you really calculate, it comes to about 35% above the percentage of interest. So there has to be a lot of disclosure. That's the first fundamental thing. They employ a number of unlawful elements to do the recovery.
Intimidation.
As the ordinance proposed by the government would...
Meanwhile, opposition political leaders upped the ante. They urged borrowers to stop making payments on their loans altogether. Repayment rates, previously above 90%, plunged, and banks stopped lending to microfinance companies. The industry's Vijay Mahajan says these developments have paralyzed business and imperiled a critical source of credit for the poor.
Instead of going after a few incidents where extreme overlending had been done, or going after one or two institutions which had systematically engaged in such practices, the entire sector was converted into a demon.
Mahajan defends several practices singled out for criticism, like weekly collections. Laborers get paid weekly, he says. As for interest rates, he says microlenders themselves borrow from banks at 12 to 13% interest and incur high costs going door-to-door to collect payments. However, critics say these commercial microloan companies cared more about the profit of their investors than the welfare of their clients. Ila Bhatt, who runs the much smaller non-profit Sewa Bank, says people at the very margins of the economy need much more than credit because many of their most basic needs are not met.
There are so many gaps, so many leaks in the life of the poor. And for them, livelihood is very central. Unless we have something really concrete to improve the livelihoods conditions so that they have more income, all these have to be done. Otherwise, only microcredit is just flimsy.
In other words, she says loans should be used to finance productive activities that generate new income. In Andhra Pradesh, the government says two-thirds of the loans were used for everyday household needs. But, and many development experts say, commercialization has distorted the central mission of microlending. But Basics' Mahajan says there's simply not enough money in the non-profit or charity world.
The capital investment that's required to meet all the, you know, unmet needs of poor people in this country and the world, for all kinds of things. It runs into trillions of dollars, and you need, therefore, mainstream capital to actually underpin any attempts at addressing this in a business-like way.
Mahajan agrees microlenders will have to return to lending strictly for income-generating activities. For now, banks have slowly resumed lending to the companies, and both he and regulator Subramaniam Reddy say it's critical that borrowers now resume paying back their loans, though Reddy says they'll have to be rescheduled with lower payments and longer payback periods.
So you would like for people in distress to have a loan modification, not loan forgiveness, basically.
Absolutely. Clearly, many of these loans are unsustainable, but yes, I mean, no loan forgiveness.
There's broad consensus that microfinance can be an effective tool to bring hundreds of millions of poor people into the global economy as participants in one of the world's fastest growing economies. But the more immediate task is to clean up the microfinance industry that's been spawned in India, one that right now looks very much like the American subprime mess. For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, this is Fred DeSamlazaro in Hyderabad, India.
In Washington, D.C., tens of thousands of abortion opponents gathered for the annual March for Life, marking the 38th anniversary of Roe v. Wade. Several lawmakers, including House Majority Leader Eric Cantor, addressed the protesters, who then marched to the Supreme Court to voice their opposition to legal abortion. In Bangladesh, tens of thousands of Muslims prayed for peace and a renewal of Islam at the annual World Congregation of Muslims, one of the world's largest Islamic gatherings. And in China and Taiwan, prayers for good fortune in the coming year. The Chinese New Year is on February 3rd. This will be the year of the rabbit, traditionally thought to be a year of calm. That's our program for now. I'm Bob Abernethy. We have much more on our website, including lots of religious analysis of the President's State of the Union address. You can comment on all of our stories and share them. Audio and video podcasts are also available, and you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Find us on YouTube and watch us anytime, anywhere, on smartphones and iPhones with our mobile web app. Join us at pbs.org. As we leave you, scenes from a memorial service held at Auschwitz in Poland for the United Nations International Holocaust Remembrance Day on Thursday.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company. And the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Be more. PBS.